නමෝ තස්ස භගවතෝ අරහතෝ සම්මා සම්බුද්දස්ස නමෝ තස්ස භගවතෝ අරහතෝ සම්මා සම්බුද්දස්ස නමෝ තස්ස භගවතෝ අරහතෝ සම්මා සම්බුද්දස්ස So dear friends in Dhamma, we were discussing Alagaddupama Sutta, which is the 22nd Sutta of Majjhima Nikaya. A very interesting sutta and explaining different aspects of Dhamma. And again, the whole sutta started with a problem actually, an issue happened within the Sangha. That is one monk called Aritta. He started putting a kind of wrong or misrepresentation of the Buddha's teaching, mentioning that certain things that Buddha has mentioned as obstructions for the well-being of the Dhamma and again so the achievement of the one's spiritual aspirations, spiritual goals. So those are not obstructions. So he is basically telling something completely different than what Buddha has mentioned. So Buddha, time to time, with various examples, with various similes, has explained that there are certain obstructive matters, obstructive reasons, causes, which can be obstructive to the spiritual path. So those are well mentioned. And so this Aritta seems to have very much objected in that, and particularly with respect to the five sensual cords, five sensual pleasures, that he is talking against. Now various other bhikkhus tried to convince him, but they failed, and then they informed to the Buddha, and then Buddha summoned Venerable Aritta and tried to convince him. Still he couldn't very much like abandon the wrong view. So establishing oneself or having kind of a pernicious view is one level, and the other thing is when someone has interrogated, when someone has tried to convince, being unable to abandon that view indicates some kind of a strong adherence, strong clinging, grasping to that particular view. Probably you can remember that we have discussed about the ditti upadana, how one can strongly grasp a certain view. So here we can see how Aritta has strongly grasped a certain view, and even though the other monks are trying to explain him, still he can't abandon that. And again now Buddha is trying to convince him, and we'll see whether he would be able to abandon that. So actually, apart from Buddha explaining various obstructive matters to the spiritual path, now he wants to verify whether other monks also have certain these kind of pernicious views. Because as you know, during the old days there were no written material, and as a result of that, what Buddha taught being transferred from generation to generation through the oral tradition. And if something went wrong in between, so then there will be there kind of a significant impact to the Buddha's teaching. So in this sutta we can see how careful and how serious Buddha on this matter, and he didn't want to misrepresent his Dhamma. So he is so critical about this matter, so therefore he is now again and again explaining certain salient aspects of the Dhamma. And last time we discussed about six standpoints for what we call the dittis, standpoints for views, wrong views. And Buddha mentioned that they can further lead to wrong perceptions, wrong views, and those are called dittithana, the standpoints for views. And then we discussed certain other points, that impermanence and non-self-related information were included in this particular sutta. And Buddha in a way kind of challenged the monks, telling that if you like you can acquire anything which is permanent, everlasting, eternal, not subject to change, and it will last till the eternity. So if you like you can grasp that But then Buddha asked from the monks, have you ever found or have you ever heard, have you come across such thing? And then the monks answer, there is no such thing. We couldn't find such thing. And Buddha then seconded it, telling that he too couldn't find such thing, which is permanent, everlasting, eternal, not subjected to change, and that might endure as long as eternity. There is no such thing. And then further Buddha mentioned about the fourth type of grasping, that is called the attavada upadana. If you like, you can grasp the attavada upadana, the sense of I, the sense of self. You can grasp it, but the condition is, it should not promote any kind of despair, any kind of sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, etc., etc. And basically, idea is, the moment that there is a sense of I, it generates certain amount of frustration, certain amount of unrest, kind of a clinging, kind of a grasping, and that grasping itself is suffering. The more the mind becomes subtler and subtler, refined and refined, sensitive, more and more sensitive, one may understand the kind of the burden of this sense of I. So anyway, here Buddha challenged monks, if you like, you can grasp the sense of I, but it should not have any kind of despair, any kind of sorrow, any kind of lamentation, any kind of mental frustration. And then he asked whether you found such type of sense of I, grasping of sense of I, attava dupadana. And then monks answer, there is no such thing. So likewise, now Buddha get on to different ways how monks are very much attuned with the proper Dhamma. Now certain interesting points of the Dhamma, again and again Buddha highlighted. And here, then another point highlighted here is that the sense of I leads to the belongings of I. And then the belongings of I, or the possessions of myself, what we call as the mind, will lead to the sense of I. So they have kind of an interconnection. So when there is I, there should be something belong to I. When there is something belong to I, it indicates that I exist. So they are interdependent. So now the point is, when one goes through Satipatthana, when one goes through insight practice, one can't find out such kind of a I. You can't find such kind of a self within the body, within feelings, within perceptions, within mental formations, or within the various kinds of consciousness. Now this is not mere logic, rather someone that trying to practice Vipassana is one of the one of his goal or the objective is to understand how these five aggregates are operating. So when he is dealing with Kayanupassana, he is trying to understand the form aggregate. When he is dealing with Vedananupassana, he is trying to understand the feelings aggregate. When he is dealing with the Chittanupassana, he is trying to recognize consciousness aggregate, mental formations aggregate, and even certain amount of perceptions aggregate. And when one deals with Dhammanupassana, he is dealing with all five aggregates. So likewise, we can see the whole Satipatthana practice is a kind of a methodology to understand the proper nature, the real nature of the five aggregates. So more one practice, one would understand there is no inner core, there is no anything substantial, there is no lasting or everlasting self in any of these five aggregates. Now, when Buddha asking this question from the monks, that is, have you come across the sense of I available within any kind of an aggregate? Then they are answering that it is not possible, it is not available such thing. Because since a self and what belongs to a self are not apprehended as true and established, Now, this is not mere doctrine or this is not mere statement. Rather, after a fair investigation, one would understand these aggregates does not have such kind of a self, does not have something belonging to self. So therefore, it is practice-oriented. It is not that merely we are trying to build a logic here. It appears like Buddha is trying to convince the monks through logic. But more than that, so when monks are answering that there is no such thing, so that indicates they not merely understood it as a doctrine, rather they went through a fair amount of practice and they themselves couldn't find out anything belong to self and again any self. So probably just to give you a simple example, say if you are practicing Dhatu Manasikara, the elements meditation, so you may start as a person, you may start as an individual thinking that there is I am the one practicing. But later, as you are refining your practice, so you have a fairly concentrated mind and again you are trying to recognize various elements' characteristics. And now you understand how the earth characteristics manifest, how water characteristics manifest, how air characteristics manifest, and how heat characteristics manifest. So basically, understanding these different characteristics. So one would further and further continue the practice, and the mind may question, so apart from these four elements, there is nothing substantial here. Within the body, there is no core, there is nothing substantial, but the continuous change of this matter, continuous change of all these different elements, that is available. So that is continuously happening. So when things are constantly changing, constantly vulnerable, fairly transient, how can one recognize a lasting self? How can one recognize something substantial? Because constantly things are changing. They are utterly in a kind of a flux. So through investigation, therefore, one would find, so there is no something solid here, there is no something substantial here. There is nothing lasting forever. Things are constantly changing. So therefore, one would further and further understand this material form does not have any kind of a self. And you can't say that it belongs to the self. So likewise, so if one continues the elements meditation, it is not only the internal body, internal matter, even the external matter, external forms, one can inferentially recognize, there is nothing substantial even in the outside. So likewise, one's understanding with respect to non-self is developing, and even it start with the understanding of the impermanence. So as these insights are developing, so one would understand, this material form doesn't have any kind of a self and doesn't have anything belonging to a self. So likewise, if one is continuing Vedanupasana, he may understand the same thing with respect to feelings. If he is continuing Chittanupasana and Dhammanupasana, he will understand the same thing with respect to the other aggregates as well. So likewise, the whole method, or we can say the mindfulness practice, Satipatthana meditation, is very much oriented towards abandoning all these wrong views. As one continues, one would further and further understand, there is no self within any of these aggregates. So therefore, when monks are answering, there is nothing that we can recognize belonging to a self or individually as a self, then that previous notions, previous views are not proper. Expecting that self or something belongs to self is something that one can't accept. So therefore, if someone is having such kind of a view, then Buddha mentioned, would it not be an utterly and completely foolish teaching? And then the other monks are answering, yes, It's a foolish teaching. And then now it's again and again now Buddha is asking about the five aggregates. Is material form permanent or impermanent? Impermanent, venerable sir. Is what is impermanent suffering or happiness? Suffering, venerable sir. Is what is impermanent suffering and subject to change? Fit to be regarded thus, this is mine, this is I am, this is myself, no venerable sir. So similarly he is asking with respect to the feelings, perceptions, formations and the consciousness. Now all these appear like simple questions, but it is not mere question and answer session. Rather, monks have to have some deeper understanding that they have gained through their own practice. Now, this is actually verified in certain other suttas, like the same kind of questioning happens again and again in certain other suttas also. And sometimes Buddha cross-question, are you simply answering me just to out of respect to me? Or did you really verify it? Did you really experientially recognize it, understood it? Then monks telling, it is not that we are answering you out of respect, but rather we ourselves have investigated and we couldn't find it. So likewise, very interestingly, I mean, these things are confirmed through practice, through the practices, not through the book, through the logical thinking, rationalizing. Rather, through the practice one may understand, okay, there is nothing substantial, everything is subject to change, things are inconstant, and as a result of that, things are suffering, because it is constantly obstructed by this arising and passing away. So as a result of that, things are suffering, unsatisfactory. And when things are constantly changing, where can we find out a lasting self? Where can we find out something eternal? So it is impossible. So all these main three characteristics, anicca, dukkha, anatta, is something that here also Buddha highlighted. And now he is trying to further enumerate it, telling that each aggregate has 11 aspects. That is past, future, present, internal, external, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, far or near. So all these different forms, there is no such kind of self belonging to self. The same thing is repeated for feelings, perceptions, mental formations and the consciousness. Now when one is continuing like this, now one interesting result is the disenchantment. Now this is something that if you are practicing Satipatthana, it will naturally happen within you. So that is where, I mean, these are not mere questioning, rather the result also mentioned here. Seen thus, bhikkhus, a well-taught noble disciple becomes disenchanted with material form, disenchanted with feelings, disenchanted with perception, disenchanted with formation, disenchanted with consciousness. Now, learning it, understanding it, experiencing it through one's own practice, slowly change the mind in a way. Typically, mind's attitude need to grasp is to grasp, but here, as a result of the practice, now one may understand the reality, how they are true nature. So, when they understand their true nature, slowly mind will start abandoning things. Mind prefers seclusion. Rather than grasping form, rather than grasping feelings, rather than grasping perceptions, rather than grasping, say, mental formation, so consciousness, conscious experience. So now mind is interested of being secluded. It likes to be alone. It likes to be independent, because it understood there is nothing to grasp. There is nothing substantial to grasp. There is no point of grasping. It is now very much like become confident, I can stand alone. I can be alone. I can be secluded. Nothing would happen. Nothing to be feared. So likewise, so Now mind become disenchanted, dispassionate, and when dispassion is available, mind become liberated. Now, this liberation may be temporary when one is continuing one's vipassana practice. So, as a result of the vipassana practice, when the vipassana knowledges are somewhat sharpened, a sudden liberation can happen. Liberation in the sense that the grasping can be completely uprooted, but only for a limited time. So it's a temporary liberation, it's a temporary abandonment, it's a temporary release, temporary freedom. So that temporary freedom is repeatable. So one is continuing again and again the practice, and so one can repeat this experience. At the beginning, one didn't even expect such things, so one didn't even recognize it. But if one is continuing one's practice, so this the experience of release, experience of freedom happens again and again. Then one may start recognizing it. One may start recognizing it. Now it's a matter of further and further enhancing it. How to maintain it for a little bit longer. So it's a matter of consolidating that release. So that is how actually we have to mature in vipassana. So you may continue the practice. As a result of that, you may get a temporary release. That temporary release has to be somewhat cultivated, seasoned, so that you are maturing in it. So these are very interestingly explained in certain other suttas as well. So when one recognizes that temporary freedom, so one needs to establish in that temporary freedom, and in a way we can say one needs to have a kind of a transition from doing mode to being mode. So previously, in order to achieve this temporary freedom, we were in a doing mode, always practicing, and recognizing various phenomena, investigating various phenomena, developing a fair amount of knowledge, the insight. So this is very much like in a doing mode. But when you are trying to be in the temporary release, now you are switching to the being mode. So there's a kind of a transition. So one needs to understand this transition, otherwise continuously one may in the doing mode. So that is also wrong. So when one's mind releases, so that has to be cultivated in a different way. So one's attitude has to be changed. Previously, one's attitude is something like, I am striving, I am struggling, I need to achieve it, I need to practice, I have to follow the schedule. So this is the kind of an attitude. But later, when you are experiencing release, when you are kind of tasting the freedom, so that freedom has to be enhanced, that freedom has to be lived. So how we are living? By not doing, by just being. Therefore, a very interesting transition happens here. So your whole practice has to change from doing to being. Now Buddha explains about the Arahant. But that's also interesting. Katancha bhikkave bhikkhu ukkitta paligo hoti. Now, certain explanations about the Arahant is added to the sutta, and it is very much like oriented like a destruction of a fortress. Now we can say the fortress is belonging to the Mara, and this particular monk who is an Arahant has completely destroyed that. So the Mara's fortress has destroyed. So the certain components of that Mara's fortress are indicated here, and that is a crossbar, which is blocking the people going in, or whoever trying to come in to the fortress, they are unable to come in because of the crossbar. That is called Ukkitta Paligo. Sorry, the Paliga. And the Ukkitta Paligo means that the Arahant has opened the door. He has gone in. Now, he has destroyed the door. Katanja bhikkhave bhikkhu ukkitta paligo hoti. And what is the bhikkhu? One whose crossbar has been lifted. Here the bhikkhu has abandoned ignorance. So in a metaphorical way, so the ukkitta paliga means the lifting of the crossbar. So that means the abandonment of the ignorance. So till we have fair amount of ignorance, avijja, so that means we haven't opened up yet. We couldn't open the door yet. So how Buddha explaining this is in a way quite interesting. Taking the fortress as a metaphor, and we can say it is the fortress of the Mara. And now either you're being imprisoned there, and now you are destroying it and coming out. Or else you are simply attacking it and destroying it. Whatever the way we can represent it, interpret it, we can say we were imprisoned in that fortress and now we were able to open the door. So open the door, or the crossbar has been lifted so that you are able to coming out. And that represent metaphorically to the abandonment of the ignorance. So we have a certain amount of ignorance, we don't know the reality, but through the practice now slowly we are improving or increasing our knowledge, understanding. So the realizations are happening. So that means the abandonment of the ignorance. So when one is able to completely abandon the ignorance, so that means one has lifted the crossbar. And then Buddha mentioned, katancha bhikkave bhikkhu sankinna parikho. So parikha means the water, what you call as the trench. That means, you know, in a old fortress, there is a surrounding water, canal-like thing?
Moat.
So this trench is also similar to that?
Water in it, that's a moat, I think.
Okay, moat. Whose trench has been filled in. What is that? Bhikkhu sankinna parikho. Sankinna parikho. I think that is the thing. Trench. What is the meaning of the trench?
It's like a pit.
Pit. Ground, like pit. Trench. Okay. So
I
maybe kind of a maybe with water or without water, but I mean it's again a kind of a obstacle for the intruding people, right?
It's like dug into the ground. So like if somebody were to like walk, like try to
they have to cross
over the other side.
Right. Either they have to jump or either they have to somehow cross it.
Mm-hmm.
So
the dictionary says ditch.
Ditch.
Trench is a ditch. Especially one dug for cover in battle.
Battle, exactly. So now in this fortress there is a kind of a ditch, a trench, so that the intruders can't come in. But this particular monk has destroyed that or has filled it. So now he can quickly, easily go through it. So now explaining it is that the simile representing abandonment of round of birds. So this similes has some deeper meanings. So if we know, we couldn't cross over because of the ditch, because of the trench. So as a result of that, within this whole realm, in this, we can say, in the samsara, we were roaming. We were again and again coming to rebirths. Couldn't find an escape. Again and again going around and round, getting into birth and then death, again birth and death, birth and death. So we are in a kind of circulating this whole thing, because we couldn't cross this trench. But now somehow that trench is filled, and now he could cross over. He could get into the other shore. So that represents abandonment of the round of birth. And then, so the next one, abhula siko, katancha bhikkave bhikkhu abhula esiko. That means esika means the what you call this indrakila, the pillar. So in the typical fortress, in the old fortress, there is a kind of a strong pillar in the middle, to which it seems like the certain safety locks and something were connected. Now, if one is able to completely uproot this pillar, that means all the doors can be opened, all the those safety mechanisms can be destroyed. And how is the bhikkhu one whose pillar has been uprooted? So that means the craving has uprooted. Here the bhikkhu has abandoned craving. So if one is able to abandon craving, so that means the pillar of the Mara's fortress has been uprooted. Ukkitta abhula siko, abhula esiko. And then niraggalo. Katancha bhikkave bhikkhu niraggalo hoti. Ida bhikkave bhikkhuno pancha oram bhagyani sanyojanani pahinani hondi. Niraggalo. And how is the bhikkhu one who has no bolt? Here the bhikkhu has abandoned the five lower fetters, has cut them off at the root. So you know that there are 10 fetters typically explained in the Dhamma, the 5 lower fetters and the 5 upper fetters. So the 5 lower fetters, we call them as the Orambhagya Sangyojana, and then the 5 higher fetters, we call them as the Uddambhagya Sangyojana. So among these 5 lower fetters, 3 fetters actually abandon when one becomes a Sotapanna. Sakkaya Ditti, that is the personality view, Vichikicca, the doubt, and Silabbata Paramasa, the various observances, rituals, thinking that they will belong or they will provide kind of emancipation. So those 3 fetters actually abandon when one becomes a Sotapanna. When one becomes a Sakadagami, the Kamaraga Patiga, the sensual desire and the ill will are somewhat diluted. When one becomes Anagami, then only that those two are abandoned, so one then becomes a non-returner. So non-returner has abandoned all 5 lower fetters. Now here, talking, the theme is for an Anagami, that who has abandoned the 5 lower fetters, and he is very much like, in the particular fortress, all the bolts were removed, so he can quickly go out. Then, panna dhajo, katancha bhikkave bhikkhu ariyo panna dhajo, panna bharo, visangyutto hoti. Now this is the arahant. So this asmimana is actually belonging to the upper fetters. That asmimana can be only removed by an arahant. As we know that there are 5 more fetters: ruparaga, aruparaga, mana, uddaccha, avijja. Ruparaga is the kind of a desire for material realms. Aruparaga means kind of a desire for immaterial realms. Mana, conceit, the conceit I am. Uddaccha, that means the restlessness. Avijja is the ignorance. So these are the very subtle form of defilements, and even an anagami still have them. These 5 fetters, indicating that one has abandoned the asmimana, that indicates that all 5 upper fetters are abandoned. කතංච භික්කවේ බිකෝ අරියෝ පන්න දජෝ පන්න බහාරෝ විසංයුත්තෝ හෝති. So panna dhajo, that means the banner has lowered. Now you know that people, when they are conceited, so they are very much like holding a banner. So they want to show off, they want to, you know, highlight themselves. They want to show that they are the best. The others are quite belittled. I am the best, I am the boss. So that is the indication that their banner is, I mean, they are holding the banner. They are holding the kind of a flag. That Pannadajo means the opposite, that they have, the one has lowered the banner. One has lowered the flag. That means one become very humble. The conceit has abandoned. The conceit has many forms. So one can become conceited because of one's skills. One can become conceited because of one's clan, one's education, one's appearance, one's strength. All these different possibilities are there with respect to the conceit. Now all these different conceit is abandoned. And on the other hand, we can say there are three main types of conceit. That is, one thinks that I am better than the other person, what we call as the Seyyamana, and then thinking that I am equal to the other person, that is the Sadisamana, and then thinking that I am inferior to the other person, what we call as the Heenamana. All these three types of conceit are abandoned. So it happens only to the Arahant. Therefore he is called Panna Dhajo. And then Panna Bharo. So Panna Bharo means that he has kept aside the weight, kind of a load, whose burden is lowered. Now he was carrying a burden, carrying a heavy load, and all that burden has kept aside. Now typically we can represent it using the upadhi, upadhi patani saggo. So upadhi represents various kinds of acquisitions through which one is indicating oneself, through which one is defining oneself, through which one is, representing oneself. Now all those upadhis are now kept aside. All these upadhis are abandoned. As a result of that, he become quite free, lighter, his mind is lighter, and doesn't feel like as a kind of an individual, doesn't feel like as a conceited person. So that is the Panna Bharo. Then Visangyutto. Visangyutto means who is unfettered. There are no fetters at all. Here Bhikkhu has abandoned the conceit I am. So the conceit I am is one of the root cause of many, many other defilements. The conceit I am. So we basically have this conceit I am, Asmimana, and this Asmimana is the one actually causing various other defilements, causing different formations, mental formations, and ignorance, establishment of the consciousness, and many whole operation of the mentality is based upon this Asmimana, and whole conceptual proliferation is based upon this Asmimana. Mulam papancha sanya iti viditva manta asmi iti sabbang uparunde. So basically, Buddha mentioned that knowing asmimana, the conceit I am, is the root cause of conceptual proliferation. Using wisdom, one needs to abandon that. So likewise, so here, abandoning of asmimana, that means he has become an arahant. Katancha bhikkhave bhikkhu ariyo panna dhajo panna bharo visangyutto hoti. Ida bhikkhave bhikkhuno asmimano pahino hoti. Ucchinna moolo thala vattu kato anabhavam kato ayating anupada dhammo evanko bhikkhave bhikkhu ariyo panna dhajo panna bharo visangyutto hoti. Because when the gods with Indra, with Brahma, and with Pajapati, seek a bhikkhu who is thus liberated in mind. they do not find anything of which they could say, the consciousness of one thus gone is supported by this. Why is that? One thus gone, I say, is untraceable here and now. Evang vimutta cittanko bhikkave bhikkuno bhikkhun sainda deva sabrahmaka sapajatika sapajapatika anvesam nadi gacchanti idan nisitam tathagatassa vinyananti pankissa hetu ditteva aham bhikkave dhamme tathagatam ananu vijjoti padami evang vadin ko mang bhikkave evang akkhai eke samana brahmana asata tuccha musa. So that is something further with respect to the Buddha. Now the one point here highlighted is that when once all the 10 fetters are abandoned, so his consciousness is not established. He basically have unestablished consciousness, what we call as the appatittita vijnana. So till one has raga dosa moha, lust, hatred, delusion, at least time to time the consciousness get established. So maybe vipassana yogi may temporarily have an unestablished consciousness, but very temporary. Again and again it go and establish. Because of avijja, there are again mental formations. Again, the consciousness is fabricated. Consciousness is entangled with the name and form. But when completely raga, dosa, moha are abandoned, so that means there is no avijja, there is no craving, there is no tanha. As a result of that, there are no mental formations. And as a result of that, the consciousness is not established. Consciousness is not prepared. Consciousness is not further constructed. So the continuation may happen till the, you know, the five, the momentum is available of the five aggregates. But now the arahant has become, we can say, as Buddha mentioned here, the even the devas, even the brahmas can't find out the establishment of their consciousness. There are very interesting certain similes that Buddha mentioned, sorry, the certain verses that Buddha mentioned. These great brahmas, great devas, they are coming and venerating these arahants, that they can't find out their consciousness. They can't trace their consciousness. Because if you want to trace the consciousness, they are tracing it with respect to the object that it is associating. Now, when the consciousness is not associating anything, they can't find out where it is. Now, there's an interesting simile. Akase padang natti samunu natti bahire. That means, akase padang natti. Now, if you know that birds are flying in the sky, even though they are flying, there are no traces of from where they have flown. Now, if we are walking on the sand, so we can recognize the footpath. We can recognize the signs of the foot. But when birds are flying in the sky, you can't find any trace. They simply have gone. There is no any trace. So the arahant's mind is something like that. So they are living, they are continuing, but one can't find out or one can't trace the establishment of their consciousness, what the consciousness has associated. So that is why it is called the appatittita vijnana. Unestablished consciousness is what we can say that the arahants are continuing with. And on the other hand, there is no name and form, nama rupa, getting represented in the consciousness of the arahant. So as a result of that, the typical consciousness, what we typically call as the conditioned consciousness, is always entangled with the name and form. So name and form and the conditioned consciousness are interdependent. But here, the Arahant's case is that there is no such name and form being represented, and as a result of that, there is nothing to trace. As a result of that, we can say his mind is anidassana vijnana. But we can say his consciousness is not representing anything. You can't show anything. You can't draw anything. Now, typically, if we are to draw an artwork, so we are taking a pencil and then we are drawing it on a paper. But you can't draw on the air. You can't draw on the sky. So similarly, Buddha mentioned, this anidassana means, so you can't represent anything, any name and form, in this type of consciousness, in this anidassana vijnana. So these are very interesting and very deep points with respect to the Arahant's mind. And with that, I'd like to conclude today's sutta teaching session. And we have to spend one more day to conclude the whole sutta. I think this is enough for today, and the matters we discuss are also quite deep. And with that, I'd like to conclude today's sutta teaching session. And now I like to open the session for questions. Yeah, actually from here also we are having a question. One moment. Yeah, go ahead, please.
Yes, Bhante, I wanted to thank you for your teaching and bringing it so much to the level of practice as far as recognizing the aggregates and how we cling to them and how our practice helps us to see the not-self nature of our, in regards to not-self, actually experiencing it in our practice and how Vipassana helps us do that. So thank you very much for all of the ways you bring this to our practice. It's especially when we read the suttas, like you said, there is this tendency to think, well, the bhikkhus understand the Buddha, but it's not just that they're understanding the doctrine, that they're actually practicing.
Yeah.
Because that's not all. I don't think that's pointed out in the...
Yeah. Buddha didn't cross-section the book because in this particular suttas, but there are certain other suttas. I can remember, you know, in the Mahatanha Sankhya Sutta, a similar incident has happened. One venerable called Sati, that's the name of the monk. Mm. So he thinks, he also has a pernicious view. He thinks that the consciousness is everlasting.
Mm-hmm.
So the vijnana is everlasting. So he too is having such kind of a pernicious view. And then again, similarly, Buddha questioned again and again the other monks. And when monks are answering, Buddha cross-questioned them, telling, monks, are you answering just out of respect to me? Or did you really verify that?
Yes.
And then monks are telling, no, we are not answering just to, you know, pacify you, simply to make you happy or out of respect. Rather, we ourselves have done the practice and we are telling it through experience.
Yes, and that's also really, when you pointed that out as well, it's great to know that, because I didn't realize that the Buddha had done that. But,
but you should refer
great,
that.
That's great that he as well, because I wasn't aware of that.
Yeah,
it's something that he would assume.
Yeah,
I mean, he knows that, but he brought it out to point it out especially to us that practice.
Yes.
I have one question though, and this is to do with I wanted to verify. It was a little vague to me as to. Let me explain just briefly my understanding of this. So the three obsessions of this is not mine. So that one is countering craving. And that's pretty clear because mine is like any possession that we could have. That's not mine. This body is not mine. This I am not is countering conceit. And I was wondering, can you explain that one? How is that one different from this is not myself? This I am not, this is not myself. Those two are a little vague to me.
Mm-hmm.
Can you explain those?
Yeah, I so feel, I mean, they are very close. Now, you know, the conceit I am, the typically asmimana,
yes.
Asmimana is the conceit I am. So I am. So I have a kind of feeling, a sense of I.
Yeah.
So I am. So that's a very subtle sense of I am. So representing that I exist and then you exist, and then there's a possibility of comparing myself with another person. So that is, the mana is a kind of a comparison, kind of a measurement. So in order to measure, in order to compare, then at least two individuals have to be available. So I and you. So when the sense of I is available, so then I can always compare this sense of I, that is I, and with another person.
And we're creating a boundary.
Definitely.
Between the two.
Right. And then
there
the conflict.
There really is no boundary.
There is no boundary. Exactly. There is no real boundary, but
okay. Because
of the conceit I am,
uh-huh.
I am differentiating, yes, I exist, and then you exist. Let me compare in between. Something like that. So therefore, when we are using the terminology I am, that represents the mana, the conceit.
Mm-hmm. So, I am is a boundary between subject and object.
Mm-hmm.
Two of us exist.
Correct.
And sort of a conflict.
Conflict, yeah. Conflict and comparison, measurement, the belittling and all those kind of things are there.
And this is not myself, removing the views of self based on the five aggregates.
Five aggregates.
Yeah, this is what Bhikkhu Bodhi says.
Uh-huh.
Removing the views of self based on the five aggregates. So I guess those would be the six standpoints for views.
Uh-huh.
He says that this is not myself is removing the views of the self based on the five aggregates.
Yeah, no, thing is, now in those six standpoints,
yeah.
Standpoints of view, so basically the first four are directly with respect to the four aggregates. The fifth one is talking about the external things based upon what we see, what we hear, what we sense, what we taste, and all these things. And therefore, Bhikkhu Bodhi mentioned that it may be represented in the fifth aggregate, the consciousness aggregate. So now these five points are again and again highlighted in the certain suttas, many suttas, how the sakkaya ditti, you know, when we consider the personality view. Now when we are talking about the personality view, each aggregate has four possibilities typically. Taking directly the aggregates as the self. Say if you consider the form aggregate, so this body, for example, so immediately taking this body is myself.
Mm-hmm.
That is one possibility. The other thing is, so I am, myself is something external, but that myself belongs this body.
Mm-hmm.
So self is something bigger, and that self has a possession of this body. That's another thing.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is that the self contained the body. There's a huge self. In that self, the body is contained. The last one is where the body, inside the body, there is self exist.
Mm-hmm.
So likewise, there are four possibilities with respect to each aggregate. So ultimately, there are 20 possibilities of manifestation of this sakkaya ditti. So typically explained in the suttas how these 20 possible or 20 types of sakkaya ditti when we are talking of 4 into 5.
Mm.
So it is very much similar in this ditti thana. The standpoints of views are explained in this sutta, but there is a sixth one added here that is another wrong view actually. Seems to have existed during those days, and again is existing even today, and thinking that I am a little self and there's a lasting self, a mighty self outside.
Yes.
So I'll, at the end of the death, I'm going and connecting with that mighty self, and I'm going to be eternal. So that's the representation in the sixth one.
Yes.
So when I'm grasping that, I love that, I appreciate that. So then I identify with that even. And based upon that, there may be the possibility of arising so many other wrong views. So those are the explanations given in for the six pernicious, standpoints of view.
But yeah. If I may ask, I think, you know, when we're comparing like the three types of conceit that are, you know, in superior, inferior, and equal.
Correct.
So I guess superior would be like, you know, if they were kind of like putting down somebody.
Mm.
So then I guess inferior is like where they think like, or I'm so good, you know, like,
no.
Why do you treat me that way or something like that?
No. Rather, I have a now inferiority.
Okay.
Thinking that I'm poor, I can't compete with them.
Oh,
you
like,
can see, I mean, the...
Oh, like kind of like beating yourself up. Or,
yeah, exactly.
Oh, okay.
So you are down now.
Okay.
You are down and he is superior, I am really inferior and I can't challenge him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he is better than me.
Mm-hmm.
Something like that.
And then the equal one is...
Equal one is now you say, I mean, say women are telling, okay, we are equal to men. Something like that.
Yeah.
So you are telling, okay, assume that there's a person who is somewhat greater than you.
Mm-hmm.
Suppose he's mighty and he's more talented.
Mm-hmm.
But you are telling, okay, no, he's equal to me. Yeah, I'm very similar to him. So like that, you are comparing him, but you are trying to put yourself also to the same level.
Right.
So
you don't want to accept that he is more talented.
Maybe something like that.
Oh.
You think that you are equal to him.
Oh.
Something like that.
Okay.
So there are these are the three possibilities that when we are comparing ourselves with another person, either we are thinking that we are superior, either we are thinking we are inferior, or either we are thinking we are equal.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Jennifer, if you we can put the
okay.
Yeah.
Thank you. I'd like to invite Kumi Z for the next question.
Okay. Thank you, Bhante, for your talk today. It was very helpful for me. I have a few questions. I don't know. I'll tell them all and you can explain to me.
Mm-hmm.
I was listening to your talk today about the doing and non-doing. And that we should not be meditating after a point. I would like a bit more clarification on that.
Right.
And also, I want to tell you that I have come to a stage when I feel that I don't enjoy the company that I used to enjoy very much. I'm more becoming like a recluse.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm really not ready to accept that. And I feel a little sad also.
Mm-hmm.
I want to find out why that is, and so can you explain that to me? And also, I have had some vipassana experiences. You were talking about that you get them and then you forget them and you come back and get them again. Such experiences I have had.
Mm-hmm.
Experience where doing Goenka tradition, I had this feeling that I had a, you know, like everything dissolved like thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So a little bit of a frightening experience for me.
Right.
So I would like to explain all what is going on with me, why I feel a little bit sad. At the same time, I'm very comfortable being alone also.
Mm-hmm.
But I haven't, I'm neither here nor there.
Okay, good.
And
good.
How long is it going to go on?
Yeah. So be no one. So that's a very interesting point, actually. So when you are continuing your practice, as you mentioned, say for example, when you are doing Dhatu Manasikara, so So your body can dissolve. The whole body appears like completely dissolved or disintegration. So it can be evident. Previously we had a kind of a solid body which is fixed. But later with the Dhatu elements meditation, slowly the whole things falls apart, and the whole body can be break into pieces, and the whole body can even disappear. And when you are continuing now, you can't actually get back the solid body. So you may not be, when you close your eyes, probably you can't recognize the demarcations, the boundaries of the body, because it has now fully dissolved. These things are some results of the practice, because we think that the body is solid, we think it is like a solid rock-like thing. But through the practice we understand things are changing, things are arising and passing away, and there is nothing substantial. So when these insights are arising, so mind can't further, ignorantly capture it as a solid form. So now it has completely dissolved.
Okay.
So now, it's a kind of an insight that you are getting. Okay, you, there is no self existing within this body. There is no lasting organ, or there is no lasting matter available within this body, because you yourself have understood, okay, each and every matter is arising and passing away. So earth element, water element, fire element, air element, everything is subject to change. So you can't find out anything substantial within this body. So that you can't say that I exist in this body. That is self exist within this body. So now when you experience in that, there could be a little bit of a dispassion, kind of a disinterest with respect to the body. You are not showing off, you are not trying to, adorn yourself. You feel like little secluded. So the previous perceptions have somewhat changed now. So therefore, it's a kind of a transition happens within the yogi's life. So when he is going through this kind of insights, so the previous perceptions, thinking that I am so important, that I am a very special person, I am so and so, and like to always show up, and all these type of things are now slowly abandoning, and you are becoming no one. You are becoming very much humble. And you don't want to show off, and you prefer seclusion. So these kind of things are typically happening. Later, actually, when you are used to it, slowly you are very much capable of representing even yourself without being deluded by self, without being deluded. But when it is happening for the first time, slowly, one may feel little jerky. One may feel that I want to be separate, I want to be secluded, I don't want to associate the others. So that is how mind is, interpret it. And the other question that you ask, how one needs to transfer from doing mode to being mode, so it doesn't mean that we stop meditation.
Okay.
So that the previous phase of our meditation is very much like kind of a struggle. So mind is not at all tamed. Mind is in a constant kind of a turmoil. So as a result of that, we are deliberately establishing mindfulness. We are striving, we are struggling, we are putting forth a lot of effort. So that is the practice that we do. And as a result of that practice, say slowly, we are gaining certain amount of insight. And once those insights are fairly strengthened, suppose now you are capable of freeing the mind. Temporarily, you experience a time period where there is no object, where there is no grasping. Now assume that you are continuing this practice, and now very much like that freeing mind, or the non-grasping mind, is something that you notice, something that you can recognize, and something that you can live. So when you are living there, you have to do nothing.
I see. Okay. Okay,
yeah.
Thank you. And I think I get your point. Right now I'm feeling this uneasy feeling of, you know, being neither here nor there.
Yeah. Very much.
And it goes on.
Yeah, that's very much that experience. You know, when the mind is not grasping anything, you can't feel the sense of I.
I must say that this feeling has been with me for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
I am comfortable with it, but I am finding that I don't want to mix with my friends that much, although I'm not angry with them. I want to more and more keep to myself. So that is, and you know, they wonder why I'm like that sort of thing, you know?
Mm-hmm.
How do I just let them think what they want, right?
It doesn't matter. I mean, that is another little vitakka, a subtle vitakka, subtle form of vitakka. We call it as the anavanyati padasangyutta vitakka, where, say, we think what would be the perception of myself regarding myself in the other's mind.
I see. Okay. See, I am glad I talked with you.
No, actually, all these subtle points, it is interesting that in certain suttas that Buddha highlighted. Now, typically we know vitakka, you know, the difficult thoughts, different thoughts, those are very, you know, common and easy to understand. Say, lustful thoughts, angry thoughts, somewhat entangled thought, confusion, jealousy. And those are very, I mean, easy to understand. But these kind of thoughts, what would be the perception in her mind regarding me? What would be the perception? What would they think about me? In simple terms, so that is another thought appearing in ourselves. Expecting they need to have the correct perception, correct view about myself.
Right.
There should never be a misunderstanding.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it so much.
Right.
I really do, and very grateful to you, to Saranai.
Yeah. 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 Thank you, Saranai.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Bhante. Thank you, Saranai Bhante. Can you hear me?
Yes. Yes.
Bhante, during meditation, you know, sometimes, I mean, most of the time we are doing it effortfully, but sometimes it goes to effortless mode, and then it doesn't stay there. When it happens, sometimes mind questions whether I am not as mindful as before, or sometimes I have that doubt. You know, it happened during walking meditation as well as sitting meditation. So I don't know how to be clear about that. Whether it's going in autopilot mode, or whether I'm losing my mindfulness.
Yeah, I think what you are telling is correct. So as we discussed just now, so typically we are establishing mindfulness in a deliberate manner, in a more intentional manner, more strong manner at the beginning, because otherwise mind gets shifted, mind gets distracted. But later, slowly, we can understand, okay, now mindfulness is available. I don't need to struggle. I don't need to put a lot of effort. And later assume that you are getting more and more confident, and mindfulness is available continuously for a long time. So then it's a matter of maintaining that, not that you need to put a lot of effort. And especially if you are able to maintain the mind in a free state where there is no attachment at all, so then the mindfulness is simply becomes kind of an endowment. So then we are, sometimes even I like to use the term awareness rather than the mindfulness. So that is very much like a natural possibility of the mind. It very much like. It It's not that you need to do anything to maintain mindfulness. Rather, it is there. Because all the hindrances are abandoned, all the thoughts in the sense, the attachments, the graspings are abandoned. So very much like you have come to the, the singleness with mindfulness.
Okay. Yeah, I don't think I'm there yet. But sometimes I feel like, you know, for a short period of time, I don't have thoughts, but I still can feel.
Exactly. So that is
breathing,
the
I'm breathing and I
that's
exist
right.
and everything. Yeah.
So when you reach there, just be in that. Just enjoy that.
Okay. The other thing, Bhante, during daily activities, according to Iriyapada Bhavana, you have to pay attention to every single thing what you do. But sometimes mind get tired when I do that. And then what I recently notice is if you have less, like choiceless awareness.
Mm.
So like you are not paying attention to any particular thing, but you are aware of the whole body.
Correct.
And then if there is one particular place that has more things going, then your mind goes there. But otherwise, the mind is staying with the body, but it's not particularly paying attention or there's no effort.
Exactly.
So in that way, I feel more relaxed, like calm, relaxed, like cool, easy feeling.
Correct.
So is that the way to do Bhante?
Yes, that is correct. Because, I mean, in order to come to this state, I mean, you need to abandon all the possibilities of attachment. Now, mind is not interested of the attaching. Slowly, mind is becoming secluded. Mind has the capacity to be alone. It has the confidence to be alone. Now, it is slowly building up that confidence that I don't need to attach to forms. I don't need to attach to sights. I don't need to attach to sounds, smells, tastes, tangibles or even thoughts. Let me be alone. I am just in the middle. I am at the center without any choice, without any attachment. So you are now, I mean, the mind is now learning a possibility of being secluded, being independent of any of these objects.
Yeah, it's very, I'm at the very beginning of that, Bhante. It's very short periods.
Just
moments.
Yeah.
Just moments.
Allow it to happen. When it is happening, you just be.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then the other question I have is, I listen to Moola Pariyaya Sutta by Venerable Dhammajiva Thero. And there are 18 videos. In the 9th or 10th video, during the Q&A section, someone asked if he can apply dependent origination for the things happening during meditation. And the Venerable Thero said that it can be applied only when the meditation is in effortless mode. But if it is in doing mode, no, it is not. But I was confused what he was referring to there.
I think now somewhat clear. Now say, if one is in the being mode, that means you are experiencing certain amount of release, that the mind is capable of being independent, that is no grasping. So now you have kind of an experience where there are no mental formations, there are no thoughts even, there are no preparations, you are not doing anything. And so that experience indicate certain amount of subsiding of ignorance. As a result of that, there are no mental formations. As a result of that, there is no established consciousness, or there is no name and form. So likewise, now it's a matter of experiencing the reverse order of the parisamuppada, where when the absence of avijja, there is no mental formation. When there is no mental formations, there is no consciousness. Then there is no consciousness, there is no name and form. So likewise. But on the opposite also can happen time to time. Say for example, when there is ignorance, again you start thinking, you start conceptualizing, proliferating, etc. Again the mind go and grasp, and all these things again can happen. Now if you are able to look at these two possibilities with the knowledge of a Patissamuppada, you can properly understand each and every link, how they are operating, how these things are happening as a conditioned situation, as a kind of a chain reaction kind of thing.
Okay, very clear, Bhante. Thank you very much.
Yeah, Theruvan Sarnai.
Bhante, the next is a written question, and there's two parts. It says, respected Bhante, what is the difference between avijja as meant in paticca samuppada and moha as one of the three unwholesome roots?
Yeah, I think these are very similar. Yeah, very similar. Avijja and moha are very similar, and we can call them as the synonyms. But on the other hand, sometimes when we are talking as avijja, Buddha sometimes refer it as to not knowing of the Four Noble Truths. And on the other hand, moha in general is the delusion. So not knowing the Four Noble Truths is the, say, greatest form, the best way of putting it. But in general, the moha represents the delusion. And typically, to emphasize not knowing Four Noble Truths, okay, we are representing the term avijja. But in general, when we are talking, say, as the unwholesome root, we are using the term moha.
Okay, thank you, Bhante. And the second part of the question says, an anagami is left with five fetters, including avijja. Would it be correct to say that actually he's left with avijja and that the other four fetters are manifestations of avijja? Thank you, Bhante Dharwan Sanai.
Yeah, actually here we need to understand that even at the level of Sotapanna, he has abandoned certain amount of avijja. It is not that assume that we have 100% avijja, and it is not that whole 100% is abandoned only when one becomes an arahant. Certain amount of avijja has been abandoned when one even practicing vipassana, not yet being a sotapanna. And assume that when one becomes a sotapanna, another level, little amount of, say, some amount of avijja is abandoned. So different levels or different forms of avijja may be available. So slowly, the complete eradication of avijja is happening when one becomes an arahant. So therefore, even an anagami may have certain amount of avijja, so that's why still he has other four fetters, and kamaraga, ruparaga, mana, uddaccha, avijja. So I can agree with your argument telling that the other four fetters are happening because still he has avijja. We can argue like that. So that's why typically when we are talking the asavas, typically we can call as three asavas: kamasava, bhavasava, avijjasava. So certain amount of kamasava is abandoned in the when one becomes a sotapanna. Then kamasava is completely uprooted when one becomes a anagami. But still, certain amount of bhavasava, certain amount of avijjasava is available within the anagami. And so in that avijjasava, we are putting all the other, say, different forms of defilements. So these are different explanations that sometimes explaining, sometimes giving more detailed explanation, or sometimes using as one term, the whole avijja is represented. Okay, I think we have spent a fair amount of time today also, and thank you very much for participation and all the merits that we have accumulated through our Dhamma discussion and the Sutta teaching session. We share with all the past relatives, we share with all the celestial beings, and we share with all the beings who are in need of merits, and we wish these merits help us also to attain path fruition Nibbana. While keeping these good wishes in our mind, let's recite the traditional verses. Ettavata ca amhehi sambandam punya sampadam sambe deva anumodantu sabba sampatti siddhiya ettavata chamhehi sambetang punya sampadang sambe bhuta anumodantu sabba sampatti siddhiya ettavata chamhehi sambetang punya sampadang sambe satta anumodantu sabba sampatti siddhiya Aka satta jibumata deva naga mahiddika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakkantu sasanam Aka satta jibumata deva naga mahiddika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakkantu desanam Aka satta jibumata deva naga mahiddika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakkantu mamparam Idang wo nyati nang hotu sukita huntu nyatayo. Idang wo nyati nang hotu sukita huntu nyatayo. Idang wo nyati nang hotu sukita huntu nyatayo. Imina punya kammena mami bala samagamo. Satang samagamo hotu yava nibbana pattiya. Imina punya kammena mami bala samagamo. Satang samagamo hotu yava nibbana pattiya imina punya kammena mame bala samagamo satang samagamo hotu yava nibbana pattiya sadu sadu sadu